President Clark has discussed with you the whole area of our being strangers and pilgrims here on earth, and we'd like to discuss one aspect of what we're to be doing during our pilgrimage here on earth, and that is our relationship to the state. Naturally, the state has been around as long as Christians have, perhaps not quite as long as believers have, but has been around a long time, and there have been times of considerable tension and times of which the Christians and the state have gotten along fairly well. In our country today, it looks to me like things are tending to get worse. You can't always tell where things are going, I suppose, but you can tell that there's a certain amount of momentum in a certain direction. Probably things are going to keep going that way for a while. And it looks to me like there's a certain amount of momentum in a direction towards increasing tension between the believer and the state, whether that state be the federal government or the local, the individual states of our union, or whether various varieties of the local government. I sketch out for you here in our introductory section a few of the areas of tension that exist. In recent years, there has been a declining population among students, in the at least in the lower-level schools. That may turn around here soon, but at least there has been a declining level. And yet, at the same time, there has been a considerable growth in the number of Christian schools around. And many people involved in public schooling have not been too happy about that. What it's really meant is they are not only losing students because the school population is going down, they're losing students to the Christian schools. And since many localities get paid on the basis of, by the state, of the number of students they've got, that does not help them a great deal. So, been unhappy in those directions. There's therefore tension between the public school and the Christian school in this whole area of competition for the number of students. Likewise, as I suppose most of you are aware, there have been a growing number of incidents in which there has been conflict between the state and local churches and such over oversight of Christian schools, the state claiming that it has a responsibility to see to it that its citizens are adequately educated and wondering whether the Christian schools are doing an adequate job, and the Christian schools claiming we are in fact part of the church and you stay out of our area. And that has reached its strongest form perhaps in the hassle that has occurred in Nebraska, where a number of the fathers of students there were in jail for something like 7 months over this whole matter, and where the pastor, Sullivan, I believe, is in jail right now. So certainly there's some difficulties going on there. The whole question of tax exemption for Christian organizations has been something worked out in great detail in our century in the United States, and yet there continue to be problems there on what the boundaries are and what kind of groups owe taxes. And part of the whole conflict going on here is a changing, it seems to me, interpretation of what the First Amendment guarantees. Does the First Amendment say, look, there's to be no state religion, there's to be no particular denomination or religion who is supported by tax money? Or does it say there's a wall or barrier so that there's to be no religion in secular areas and that sort of matter? Well, that sort of thing is coming up, and it's flowing over into the tax exemption area. It's coming up in the prayer and Bible reading argumentation in public schools, the whole area of whether Bible clubs can be a student interest group on the campus of a school. The general feeling seems to be at the moment that in colleges, yes, they can, but in high schools, no, they can't. And an attempt in Congress recently to pass a law by which Bible study groups and such would be on the same par with other secular interest groups for use of public school facilities did not get passed. And so that does not bode very well for the future. You're wondering whether it's even being a discrimination against religion in that area. You're also aware, I think, of the growing pluralism in our country, people who say, this is not a Christian country, and I'm not a Christian, and I don't want you pushing Christian values on me through the laws and such. And this is taking the form of a pressure for women's rights, and many of these people are Christians, but many of these are anti-Christians who are pressing for women's rights, and you can certainly see a possibility that if a very strong law were passed in that direction, if the Equal Rights Amendment were passed in that direction, certain groups in our government might feel justified in withdrawing tax exemption from any organizations that would not ordain women. On the idea that, okay, you're a religion, we're not going to mess with you on religious things, but this isn't a religious matter. This is a matter of rights, and you are discriminating against these people. Likewise, the same thing can happen with gay rights. And a suit was brought against an Orthodox Presbyterian church in California because they fired their organist when they found out that he was a homosexual. He brought suit. We can be encouraged there, I guess, that the city, that the church won the suit, that the court agreed they had the right to fire the guy in view of their own statements about personal practice and the fact that this fellow was an employee of the church. But I think if you've done much reading in the area of jurisprudence, at least in the newspapers, you get the feeling that not all judges agree on things, and it may depend very much on which judge you get. And in any case, you may wind up spending hundreds of thousands of dollars going through a court case, even if you win in the end. The Spiritual Counterfeits Project on the West Coast is having to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend themselves against a suit from the Unification Church, because the Unification Church does not like some things that they said in one of their booklets on that particular group. Well, those are the kind of things we see going on today, and most of them I do not think are going to go away. I think they're likely to become more serious tensions as time goes on. There are two types of things we need to think about in all of these areas of tension. One of the things is, of course, what is the right thing to do? A moral question. What does the Bible tell us is the right answer to the question of our praying, our having Christian schools, and our evangelizing and such, and our standing up for righteousness in our society and such? And the second question is one of to whom did God delegate authority for various things, and how much authority did he delegate to them? What are the boundaries of the authority and such? Well, the first of these two major areas of concern, what's the right thing to do, would lead us into a huge subject of morality, ethics, and particularly the whole question of what is desirable in the direction of public ethics and public morality in a society where we still are strangers and pilgrims. We're regenerate, maybe, but the society as a whole is not regenerate. We'd rather look, I think, well, rather, I don't know about it, but we're going to have time to look only at the second of these questions. Who has the authority, and how much authority do they have? And so, well, what does the Bible have to say about the relationship of believers as individuals and believers collectively in their churches and their relationship to the state, whether it be the local government, the state government, federal government, and such? So that's the second, it's that second area we want to look at today. I've divided up our discussion here as kind of a tour of not all, but a good bit of the biblical material involved. So you see here on page 1, we're going to look at the Old Testament background. On page 3, we're going to look at the New Testament teaching. And the basic approach will be to look at various arrangements that the Lord has made under each of these categories. Let's move, first of all, then, and look at the Old Testament background to the whole question of the relationship of a believer, whether individually or collectively, to the state. I think the most important thing we have to get started with in this area is the whole concept of creation. It's the fact of creation that lies at the basis of what the ultimate authority is in regard to state, in regard to private practice, and these areas. And basically here, we don't need to exegete Genesis chapter 1 and 2. It's extremely clear by just looking them over quickly that God has created the earth, the heavens and the earth. He's created everything that we're going to have any contact with physically, and he's created us. So he owns the earth, and he owns mankind. This picture is shown several places in Scripture where under various figures mankind is represented as clay and God is represented as the potter. And he makes different kinds of pottery. As the creator and owner of these materials, he has the right to make what he wants and dispose of it the way he wants to. So the picture here is that we really don't have the authority. Man, since the fall, has wanted to bring God into question over these things. Examine whether God really has the rights on these matters. I think of C.S. Lewis's collection of essays, God in the Dock. He is not talking about God and longshoremen. He is talking about God being brought into court, so to speak, by people. He's using the British use of the term dock as the place where you put the person being accused in a court case, okay? Well, the picture here really is God made us, and so whatever we've got, it's what he made, except that he made us to be creators, and we've created quite a deal of evil that God never created. We've had a little help from Satan and some of his cohorts, obviously, but picture here that God really does have the absolute authority. We do not absolutely own ourselves, and we don't absolutely own any of our property. We may own ourselves and our property in an absolute way relative to any other created being, relative to any other human, although that would have to be established itself as well. But as regards God, everything we have, ourselves and our property, is a trust from God. In a sense, we are a charitable trust, if you like, and God is the donor, and he is also the board of directors, and he's going to hold us responsible for how we administer that particular trust. We're the executive director or something of this charitable trust, and God is the board of directors. He supplies the money, and he's going to call us to account one day on how we've handled these things. Well, that very idea, God having created and owning all things, and that he has given man what each man individually has, and himself as well, his own existence, and that's a trust from God, then means that the biblical view of the individual and government is different from probably the two most common forms of government or government theory that are around today. On the one hand, you have government theory of statism, which shows up in a bunch of different ideological forms. Communism is a form of statism. The state is the ultimate arbiter on the life and fortunes and activities of the individual. Now, in fact, the way it's constructed in communist theory, it's the people. But they don't ask the people what they want, because the people don't know what they want. At least the communist theory, they don't know what they want. The Communist Party knows what they want. And the Communist Party, having taken the government, it then sets up a statist government. Now, the communists may not want a statist government at all in a place where they don't have control. They may want a very individualistic situation. They may want a situation where all the minorities have rights so that the communists can make trouble, but eventually they're going to switch over to statist control if they ever get control of the place. So you just have to know what their theory is. But certainly, as regards government where they're in power, their view is the state has absolute authority and the individual basically has none. The other end of the spectrum is individualism, the idea that the individual has absolute authority. And I don't know of any society in the world where this particular view of reality functions. There are certainly some people in this country who feel that the state transgresses its authority in building roads, and that roads ought to be built by private individuals, and charge toll or something of that sort. You won't find many people like that, but there are some people who go over an extreme end. Ayn Rand, I believe, an individualistic philosopher, is pretty heavy in this direction. But both of those, I think, are condemned by the biblical picture. The biblical picture, we might want to call theism, except the word is already used for several other purposes, so we won't call it that, but the idea that God has the absolute authority over both individual and state, and what he says is what really ought to go in regard to how a government ought to function. Well, that much from the whole area of creation. As we move through the Old Testament, we find that God successfully sets up a number of covenants, or perhaps you would prefer the term dispensation. We won't really worry about that. The difference between dispensational theology and covenant theology is not the name, although there's some tendency one way or the other. In fact, if you get down to it, it's not easy to explain what the difference between dispensational and covenant theology is, except perhaps to say that covenant theology tends to emphasize the unity of God's covenants and the unity of God's people throughout salvation history, and dispensationalism tends to emphasize the diversity of God's covenants or dispensations and God's people throughout salvation history. Well, we're going to look at the covenants of God under two subheadings, God's worldwide covenants and God's particular covenants with Israel. Whatever the answer may be to whether the United States is in some covenant relationship with God regarding believers becoming the new Israel and this state being a Christian nation in some way, there's no question that the United States at least consists of lots of Gentiles, and that whatever arrangements God made of a worldwide sort with all mankind must therefore have some implications for how our government is to function. Well, I've divided up the worldwide covenants into two here, the Adamic covenant given in Genesis chapter 1 and 2, and the Noachian covenant, the covenant with Noah given in chapter 9, verses 1 through 17. Let's have a look rather quickly at both of these. In Genesis chapter 1:28, we have the famous statement about the creation of man, previous verses. And then it says in 1:28, and God blessed them. And God said to them, so this is a blessing if you like, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. Behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that's on the surface of the earth and every tree that has seed, fruit yielding seed. It shall be food for you, given it to the beasts and such. Picture here, a covenant made with mankind by God. And basically what he does is he gives them a responsibility to populate the earth. And he gives them a responsibility to have control over the earth as a planet, I suppose. That would, it seems to me from the context, suggest over the agriculture and such of the planet, but probably over the minerals as well of the planet. And then he adds specifically in the last part of the verse, over the various things we would call the animal kingdom in its broad use. So over the vegetable, mineral, and animal kingdoms, in a sense, man is given responsibility. We're not going to get into questions of whether Earth can be understood more broadly to include the solar system, the galaxy, and such things. Those are moot questions at the moment. And yet the point here is that man is given responsibility over these. This is part of God's covenant with Adam. The term covenant does not actually occur in connection with Adam here. It does, however, occur over in Hosea, I believe. I don't have the reference here for you. Like Adam, they broke my covenant, is the phrase that occurred there in Hosea. Over in chapter 2, we have a longer passage where man is put in the garden, and the commands regarding the garden are given to him. It becomes apparent to man, as God shows him, that none of the animals are the right kind of helper for him. Certainly, man either already at this point or soon develops a capability in which various animals are helpers to him, that he is able to get milk from certain animals and he's able to use others to for meat further down the line anyway, if not now, and able to use them to help him raise crops and such. But those kind of helpers are not in the same class as creation of woman. Man and woman together forming mankind are those to whom God has entrusted these to the world. And so we see an establishment of family authority in the creation of Eve, and the whole point then fulfilling what's stated in Genesis chapter 1 about being fruitful and multiplying, filling the earth. Well, what happens with the fall? Is all of this canceled out? Well, it's messed up a little, but still there. Still there. Just as man is made in the image of God, and certainly mucks that up very severely when he falls, yet he's spoken of as being made in the image of God in Genesis chapter 9 and over in James and such. And there, the whole point of a death penalty for killing people is based on the fact that man is made in the image of God. The whole point of the incongruity of cursing man and blessing God is because man is made in the image of God. And probably the idea is if you can't love man whom you've seen, how can you love God whom you've not seen? And something of that carries over even after the fall. Don't know all the ins and outs of that. But it's pretty clear that carrying out God's covenant has definitely been made a lot more difficult by the fall. And I think as we read the rest of Scripture, we'll see that man, in fact, will never succeed in totally and properly carrying out God's covenant until the fall is removed. And so the whole thing of peace between man and the animals and the tree of life back and all of that that we see in the millennium eternal state are a picture of the covenant being able to work better once man works better. And working perfectly once man works perfectly. That's all down the line. But the covenant itself does not disappear. And in fact, the reference to the fall and the curses then have to do with this covenant. Notice the curse related to childbirth. Childbirth is not going to be totally joy as a result of the fall. And yet I think women and husbands, I'm neither a husband nor a wife, so I can't fall in these categories, but my impression is from talking to them, is that there is still some joy connected with childbirth. There's still joy in raising children, even though it's not what it would have been had it not been for the fall. And I think we see also that the family is not what it was after the fall, that it would have been before the fall. There's not a lot said about that in the biblical passage, but probably the last two lines of verse 16 of Genesis 3 relate to this whole matter. There's a disagreement among interpreters on how to handle the remarks there. To the woman he said, I'll greatly multiply your pain in childbirth, and pain you'll bring forth children. We've already discussed that. The remark is the next two lines. Yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Many interpreters have taken this, well, there's still going to be a bond between husband and wife. The wife is going to desire the husband, and the husband is going to have this authority. But the wording there is almost exactly like that at the end of Genesis 4:7, where God is talking to Cain, and he says, if you do well, won't your countenance be lifted up? If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Sin's desire is to control you, but you must master it. I think this Genesis 3:16 passage is to be read the same way. Because the fall, the wife's desire is to rule over the husband, and the husband must master that, and the husband must master that in a right way. And one of the big pictures of sin in regarding the marriage state is the conflict between the wife wanting certain authority that God didn't give her, and between man misusing the authority that God did give him. And we have this struggle going on. If you look at the curses here, you will see that in every one, something that should have been a certain way before the fall now becomes a rebellion. Because man rebelled against God, all the authority structures that man was given in the covenant are going to be marked by rebellion. And therefore, the earth rebels against man with the thorns and thistles, and man messes up the earth by polluting it and such. The animals become afraid of man, and some of them may devour man, and man begins to devour the animals, Genesis chapter 9. The childbirth is not what it should have been. The family relationship is not what it should have been. And now, throughout human history, mankind must struggle to carry out God's covenant. There seems to be something built in man to kind of naturally try to carry this out, but it's also messed up by sin. Even people who don't seem to recognize God still seem to have a desire to have authority over the earth and such. They have their own home, build their own home, build their own security, have a family and such. And I think we see some of that going on here. Okay, in this material then on the Adamic covenant, we have the origin of human authority over the inanimate, over the animate, over the family. We have the idea of property, I think, in relationship to that then. Property seen as man subduing the earth and subduing part of it to himself and such. Not explicit in the passage. We have the origin of crime with the fall. Although nothing is explicit about government beyond the family. When we move on to the Noachian covenant, it looks like we have an extension of man's authority over man. Notice in Genesis chapter 9 what's said there regarding man and the authority of man over man. Remark about being allowed to eat the animals in verses 2 through 4. I will surely require your lifeblood, verse 5, from every beast I'll require it. Beasts are to be put to death if they kill people. And from every man, from every man's brother, I'll require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. God is giving to mankind collectively in some way a right to punish men mistreating other men. And this, I think, shows us the beginning then of some kind of a governmental structure that we might call a secular government or something. Doesn't mention anything about secular. Doesn't say how men are going to shed the blood of a man who sheds other human blood, but hinted at here. Perhaps this is intended to be compared with the case of Cain. God dealt with Cain's sin, and he didn't kill him. He put a mark upon him, in fact. And the boasts of Lamech and such, that he not only got even with somebody who hurt him, he really got him back. He got it back with interest, 600% interest or something of that sort. So Here I think we see a picture of a measured response of man to man's misdeeds, and a picture then of some kind of government with the power of life and death is instituted to punish sin. We cannot tell from the statement what kind of government. Is it a clan avenger sort of situation, which we do see later on, or is it some idea then that the community would collectively get together and decide what they're going to do about human sins? Well, those are the only two covenants that the Scripture speaks of that are worldwide covenants. And it's not always easy to see from them exactly what God expects in these areas. But what is helpful to do is to go through the rest of the Old Testament and find out how God reacts to various human activities of those who are not under his additional covenants with Israel, to see what he has his prophets say about these things and what God himself does in history, how God brings judgments upon people. So at the top of page 2, basically what we're looking at is God's limitations on man by means of these worldwide arrangements. He's made these worldwide covenants. Now what's he going to do? How does he see the boundaries of human activity there? When does God think it is severe enough that he would intervene by judgments, or that he would send prophets to tell them something or another? Well, the flood is the first definite picture of God intervening, telling us that mankind is way out of line at this point, and they deserve to be wiped out over the whole matter. We're not given a lot of information about what specific things God is concerned about here, but notice Genesis chapter 6, verse 5 and following. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and was grieved in his heart. The Lord said, I'll blot out man, whom I've created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things to the birds of the sky, for I'm sorry that I have made them. And then he begins to move in the direction of preparing a deliverance for Noah and his family. Well, God says basically, there's a limit to what I will put up with in man, and I'm going to show you that. I'm going to destroy all but 8 people. And of those 8 people, we do not hear the passage say, these guys were better than all the rest. We hear the passage say, these found favor in God's sight. And we're not told then whether this is purely unmerited favor or not in the passage. As you look around at other passages in Scripture, I think you get good reason to believe that it's unmerited favor, though it probably has something to do with the faith of Noah and his family as well. General wickedness of some sort here. As we read the passage over, the wickedness of man was great, every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. You say, oh, those guys were really bad. You don't have to read too many passages in the Bible to find out that's what God says about everybody. And in fact, when he ends up his discussion of the flood, God says, I'm not going to bring another flood upon mankind because man is still evil. Say, why does he say that? Well, I think the point is that if God gave everybody what they deserved when they deserved it, there wouldn't be the human race. Picture it is. This shows us what God's attitude towards sin in the human race is. It shows us man transgressing the boundaries continually, but it also shows us that if God continues to proceed in that way, there'll be nobody left. Over in Genesis chapter 11, we have the incidents at the Tower of Babel. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words, Genesis 11:1. Came about as they journeyed east, or maybe journeyed from the east. The Hebrews were ambiguous there. They found the plain and land of Shinar, settled there. Then they make bricks and use the brick for stone, the writer tells us here, and the tar to hold the stuff together. Let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. Let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. And we seem to see here a picture of both a general disobedience and a specific pride. The disobedience I'm taking on the idea that God had told them to fill the earth. And they're obviously here don't want to be scattered. They want to stay together. So this seems to be part of the problem. And then the other, let us make for ourselves a name. And God's response is that, in fact, they will accomplish a great deal if they do this. But presumably because of what has happened to man in his fall, this great deal that they're going to accomplish under this kind of a scheme is going to be bad in the long run. And throughout human history from here on, you have, as Augustine saw, the kind of two cities theme, the city of God and the city of man. The city of man will culminate eventually in the Antichrist, and the city of God will culminate in the new heavens and new earth with the new Jerusalem. And it's the city of God that will win out eventually. But the city of man is going to culminate in the great rebellion, the greatest rebellion against God. It's clear from that passage that there's nothing per se wrong with cities. Lots of country dwellers kind of inclined to think there's something per se wrong with cities. And they point back that everything began in the garden, on the farm, back on the farm, etc. But those who are more city dwellers can point out everything's going to end up with a city. Well, maybe lots of gardens around, but it's going to be a city. And there's nothing per se wrong with either of those things. But apparently, when man is gathered together, the sinful part of his nature has a tendency collectively to dominate over what's still left of the good part of his nature. And when they're scattered out, I won't say the good part has a tendency to dominate over what's bad, maybe that's too strong, but at least they are not quite as adept in the technology of evil if they are scattered. So something of that sort seems to be going on here. Moving on to Sodom and Gomorrah, by the way, he destroyed all mankind, the eight in the flood. Doesn't appear to have destroyed anybody in Babel, although one can guess that if a high civilization went to pieces immediately because they couldn't speak one another's language, there may have been some very severe effects. If you can imagine our civilization going to pieces suddenly, there'd be some very severe effects. Turn off the electricity for a year in our country, there would be some very severe effects. There was no electricity back there, I suspect, but comparable things when you've got lots of specialized people in a civilization and they now can't communicate anymore. Sodom and Gomorrah, there's certainly destruction. A little question about that. Genesis 18 and 19. And the whole picture here of great wickedness again. Genesis 18, verse 20 and following. The Lord said, "The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great. Their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down and see if they've done entirely according to its outcry which has come to me. And if not, I will know." And after Abraham strikes a bargain with God for 10 righteous people, a city will be kept. The city isn't kept. The bargain isn't... God keeps aside the bargain, yes, but the 10 never show. We're not exactly sure what the count is, but giving everybody the benefit of the doubt, it sounds like it's 4. So none of those show off too well in the succeeding events. But again, you get a picture, I think, of general wickedness. And in the incidents regarding the angels of sodomy, homosexuality, going on there. Ezekiel 16, interestingly, mentions misuse of wealth as one of the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah. Don't really see much or anything about it in the Genesis passage, but you might want to have a look at that. This apparently is partly what God is judging Sodom and Gomorrah for. Ezekiel 16, verses 49-50. "Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters," that would presumably be the other sisters, other cities, "have not done as you and your daughters have done." God saying to Jerusalem, you're worse than Sodom at this point in history. "This was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had arrogance, abundant food, and careless ease, and did not help the poor and needy. Thus they were haughty and committed abominations against me." Picture here of pride and abominable wickedness, but seeming to have its root in the fact that the cities had become wealthy and they had become oppressive to those in the cities that could not resist them. So suggest here a misuse of wealth as well. I mention also in the whole incident of the bargaining between Abraham and God that the picture seems to be here the protective function of the righteous in the society. If I can find 10 there who are righteous, I won't destroy the city for their sake. But if they're less than 10, I'll pull them out and destroy the city. Seems to be the picture that goes on there. This might be what's going on in the remark of Jesus about being the salt of the earth. You don't have to have a lot of salt in meat to keep the stuff from rotting. Perhaps that's the idea here. You don't have to have a lot of righteous people in a city if they're doing what they ought to be to keep the place from going down the drain. But I think we can see in these three examples, God brought judgment upon Gentiles for disobedience to ethical provisions, which presumably are written in man's heart, references there in Romans, and I think we can see a misuse of the kind of things that God had put in man's hands in the whole Adamic and Noachian covenants. Another way to get even more explicit information about this is through the remarks of various prophets that God sent, when he doesn't just denounce Israel or the southern kingdom of Judah, but where he denounces the Gentile nations round about. The most concentrated material of this sort is found in the first two chapters of Amos, where Amos starts out a sermon given to the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Ephraim, or Israel, as we sometimes call it, by doing something that everybody likes to hear, and that is by preaching on the sins of the other guys. And once he gets their good attention by telling them how bad the people of Damascus and Tyre and Philistia and Edom and Ammon and Moab is, then he begins working closer home and begins, as many people say, to meddle. But in fact, he's merely proclaiming God's judgment on their own activities. Notice the crimes, the sins, for which God judges Damascus, Philistia, Edom, etc. Thus says the Lord, Amos 1:3, for three transgressions of Damascus, and for four I will not revoke its punishment, because they have threshed Gilead with implements of sharp iron. Need to do a little historical background reading here, and there's probably a figure of speech going on. Gilead is a part of the territory God gave to Israel. So Damascus has come into Israel's territory. So they're taking land away from somebody else. And they have threshed with implements of iron, probably not just the literal statement that they took the territory and harvested the grain and such. At minimum, I think it would mean they were harvesting somebody else's grain and taking it for themselves. But probably it goes further and has the idea that they mowed down the Israelites. That might be the way we'd use it. That has an agricultural background, although those of us raised in the Second World War might think in terms of machine guns or something. But I think the idea there is agricultural. Probably a mistreatment by invasion and oppression of the Jews, of the Israelites living in the land of Gilead. Over in regard to Damascus and Tyre in 1:6 and 1:9, thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Gaza and for four, Philistines, I will not revoke its punishment, because they deported an entire population to deliver it up to Edom. And then down in Tyre, about the same thing said, verse 9, because they delivered up an entire population to Edom and did not remember the covenant of brotherhood. Whether the covenant of brotherhood is a reference to either the Noachian or Adamic covenant, I can't tell for sure. This period is already after the time of David, and David certainly had some covenants with the royal house of Tyre, so which of those might have in mind is hard to tell. But the picture in both cases is a deportation scheme of some sort. One gets the idea that the Philistines wanted some of the territory of Israel adjoining theirs, that would be South Judah, and the Tyrians wanted some of the territories of Judah adjoining theirs. So they took the territory, but then they got all these people. Now you could kill all these people, but apparently these people were a little more humane than that. They sold them all into slavery to the Edomites. So the Edomites carted them off somewhere. We don't have lots of information in detail for this. That seems to be the picture. The idea, you want to expand your territory, there's some people in the way, you take their territory, and you get rid of them one way or another. And even though this is perhaps the more humane way to get rid of them, God does not like it. Mistreatment of one's fellow men in order to aggrandize yourself in one way or the other. Edom, the purchaser in both of these cases, it comes in for God's attack in verse 11. For three transgressions of Edom and for four I will not revoke its punishment, because he pursued his brother with a sword. You remember the Edomites are the descendants of Esau. Esau's brother was Jacob, and the Israelites are the descendants of Jacob, or Israel. So he pursued the Israelites with the sword. While he stifled his compassion, his anger also tore continually. He maintained his fury forever. A picture here of anger, jealousy against the Israelites, using it to lead to warfare, vengeance, and not getting over it. Continued holding a grudge sort of idea is going on here. So warfare, cruelty, and vengeance, I've suggested, is what's happening here. In 1:13, the Ammonites come in for God's judgment. They ripped open the pregnant women of Gilead in order to enlarge their borders. They too took Gilead, just as the Damascus, sort of like the, Ammonites from the south and the Damascenes from the north took the territory of Gilead when they were weak. The one group threshed them with instruments of iron, and that's not explained for us. And here, atrocities, killing pregnant women. Probably the idea, again, of deportation or slavery or something, but a woman who's pregnant needs lots of care. The child is nowhere ready to be of any value as a slave, so they don't bother. You just kill them. And God's judgment against that very, very clearly. 2:1 is a little trickier to see what the exact point is. For 3 transgressions of Moab and for 4, I will not revoke its punishment because he burned the bones of the king of Edom to lime. How he got the king of Edom into the bone state is not stated, whether he killed them or whether, having taken a territory just to mock them, went into the royal cemetery and desecrated the corpses. We don't know. Certainly, that's at least a minimum and would indicate then a mistreatment of fellow men. I think we see in all of these a theme, and by the way, that's one of the clearest ones. The king of Edom is a Gentile. The Moabites are Gentiles. So you can't say that all of the other things are just because these people are attacking God's people. They're mishandling other people. All people in one sense, we should not get confused on this, all people in one sense are God's people in that he created them and owns them. We should not let that wander over into the universalistic liberal idea that they're okay. They're not okay. We're not okay either. But we're at least redeemed if we're trusting in Christ. And God's going to straighten us up. Those who are not trusting in Christ are not Christ in that sense, but they still are created and owned by God, and there's still a responsibility for how you treat them. So that responsibility is something God is going to hold Gentiles responsible for and has already been holding them responsible for all through these passages we've seen. We need to move on, but I've listed here also what Jonah and Nahum have to say regarding the Ninevites, the Assyrians. Assyrians were a rather nasty empire in the sense that they not only took other territories without any warrant from God in that direction, misused their authority, but also that they liked cruelty, that they would skin people alive and impale them on pointed posts and things like that. So Jonah speaks out very strongly against the wickedness. Jonah knows enough of what they're like that he really feels that he can't obey God when God goes to tells him to go warn them. And God has to apply some pretty strong force to even get Jonah to be willing to go warn them. And they do turn back for a while, but it doesn't last. Nahum, written perhaps a century or thereabouts after Jonah, pictures the final destruction of Nineveh and the Assyrian Empire. And if you look through those passages, wickedness, apparently enmity towards God, Nahum 1:2 is speaking generally, but it's going to be applied to the Ninevites further on in the book, afflicting the Jews and afflicting people in general. 3:19 winds up, against whom has your wickedness not been practiced? He's picturing the rejoicing of all the nations around when the Assyrian Empire collapses because they've mistreated everybody. And the picture, again, I think, is God's view of what they're doing. 2 examples in Daniel of his judgment on Babylonian kings. Nebuchadnezzar first cried, "Isn't this the great Babylon I've built? Aren't I great? Here's my city. I'm the greatest," etc. And God basically lets Nebuchadnezzar learn that if Nebuchadnezzar is great, it's because God made him great. And God can make him ungreat very quickly. So he winds up in this boanthropy or whatever it is. We don't know whether God used some kind of insanity that already existed or whether he did a special case there. But Nebuchadnezzar winds up being like a cow for several years. And an amazing thing that when God straightens up Nebuchadnezzar, he also gives him his empire back. Very, very few people have ever lost an empire for a few years and gotten it back by just coming up and saying, "Well, fellows, here I am." Napoleon's about the only one that ever came near it that I can think of. And he had some fellows that didn't agree with him. It didn't work out. Nebuchadnezzar's pride. And Belshazzar, same thing. Belshazzar, having a big feast, decides to get out all the gold and silver drinking cups that come from the temple of God and drink out of them. And God says, "Enough. I've measured you in the balance." Idea of weighing someone in a balance scale. You're light. You don't measure up. So I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to divide your kingdom. I'm going to give it to somebody else. The picture in all of these is that God providentially is working out a certain justice. We might call it a rough justice in this life, that if a nation behaves itself in a really wicked way, God will catch up with it sooner or later. God will cause it to become sufficiently weak by either disasters of a natural or of a personal sort, and that nation will go down the drain. God's specific and very specialized and detailed and exact justice will come at the last judgment. But his rough justice is already operating today. And it's based upon the very kind of moral principles which all of us have and like to use on others, but don't like to see used on ourselves. And it's based upon the covenants which God made with man. Now we move over to the whole question of God's covenants with Israel. The previous covenants were made with all mankind, and I think there's warrant to think they're still in force, whether or not the gospel has been seen in those areas. The covenants we're going to discuss below, the Old Testament and New Testament covenants, apply to restricted groups, Israel, to the church and such, but some warrant that these may be broadened as you come into the millennium. The picture at the end of Zechariah 14, whereas the most holy place was a very small area, and the holy place was a little larger area and such. Now, in the probably millennial New Jerusalem, not only is the high priest going to have a little placard that says, "Holy to the Lord," on his head, all the horses are going to have "Holy to the Lord" written on them. Not only are the few bowls that are kept in the temple going to be holy, that you cook the sacrificial meat in it for the banquets that were held there, but every pot in the whole city is going to be holy. You're going to have a expansion of holiness, that the whole city is, in a sense, going to become the temple for presumably the whole world. So I think we see some hints that there's an expansion of covenants in the millennial period. Unless the all-millennialists are right, we aren't there yet. I think it's still helpful to see what happens in these covenants. And again, we're thinking of the whole state, individual, state, people of God, a connection here. The Abrahamic connection then, the Abrahamic covenant worked out in several chapters here, doesn't establish an explicit form of government. It does, of course, expand the promises of blessing. The hint that somehow a deliverance will be wrought by God that we see spoken of in Genesis 3:15 now is made more explicit, that all nations will be blessed in Abraham. A hint that this that's going on is not just for Abraham. The details come in the Mosaic Covenant laid out for us in the rest of the Pentateuch. And in regard to government, I think we get three officials, we might say, who belong to government taken in a broad sense. The prophet and the priest and the king. And as I point out, the priest and king, at least, are kept very strictly separate in the biblical material. One can argue that perhaps Samuel is some kind of a interim priest. Doesn't seem to be the right family, but there's nobody around that's doing the right things. And he's a prophet of some sort, maybe even a judge, but certainly never officially a king. The material regarding the prophet is worked out for us in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 15 through 22, where we're told that the prophet is chosen by God and sent by God. It's not a dynastic thing. You're being a son of a prophet doesn't make you a prophet. I'm using son of a prophet in a physical descent case, not in the sense of being a student of a prophet, although probably even that sense there's a distinction. You remember Amos, as it says, "I'm not a prophet nor a son of a prophet." I think he means I didn't grow up as a prophet, and I didn't study with one of the prophets. God intervened to make him one further on, looking at his background. They're individual, and they're to be put to death if they presumptuously speak a word from the Lord. If you look at the context and ask yourself who's to put them to death, the prophet that speaks a word presumptuously shall die. You might say, well, maybe that's God promising that he'll kill a prophet if the prophet speaks presumptuously. Well, immediately there's a question in the context. If you say in your heart, "How shall we know a word which the Lord has not spoken?" If God intended to put them to death, he would have said, well, if the ground opens up under that guy, that's one that has spoken something that I didn't send him. Or if a bolt of lightning comes down and converts him into charcoal, that's a word which I've not sent. But he doesn't say that. He says, if he speaks a word and it doesn't come to pass, that's one whom I have not sent. Don't be afraid of him. And I think the implication is, here's your test. If you've got two witnesses that this fellow has made a prediction and it has been falsified by the events, then he's not a true prophet. He needs to undergo the death penalty. You see some connections already between government and religion right at that point, I think. There's also some connections in the other direction, perhaps, that the prophets act as we might call advisors to the government. Everybody is to listen to what the prophets say, presumably the kings as well. And in fact, we'll see, as we look at some specific examples here on the next page of our notes, that in fact we do have this kind of interaction between prophet and king. The prophet telling them what God wants them to do, and the king's either doing it or not doing it, and incurring God's judgment if they don't. So that's one office, and you can see it's got some contacts with the relationship between God, the believer and the government. The priest is chosen, and most of the material on his choosing is in Exodus 28 and 29. Chosen by God as a dynasty. Automatic succession. Supposed to be sons of Aaron. Doesn't tell you exactly how you decide who the high priest is among these priests. They apparently had something worked out, whether it was the eldest or it ran through a particular line. It's the eldest son in each line. If qualified, there are a number of qualifications he'd have to satisfy. I don't know. We begin to see it being used in political football in the intertestament period with kings appointing them and such, but appears to have been some automatic mechanism for succession here. Characteristics of the priest are clearly specified by the law. We're not told who's to enforce it, whether the king or such, or whether the priests as a group, not told. But it is to be enforced in some way. As best I can tell, the priest has no government functions. Priests begin to pick up some in the intertestament period when the Israelites have lost their right to self-government. God has allowed the Babylonians to come in and the Persians to succeed them, the Greeks to succeed them, and finally the Romans to succeed them. But does not appear to have any government functions specified in Scripture. The king has his qualifications and duties laid out in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 through 20. Chosen to be from God. All of these, by the way, are to be Israelites. You look back in the prophet passage, one of your people. Same thing in the Deuteronomy 17 passage, one of your people. And, of course, the priest was to be a descendant of Aaron, so automatically had to be one of their people. Might wonder if that's generalizable in some sense to today. Have to think about that. Presumably the generalization then would be people that would be chosen for these kind of positions would be believers in some sense. We'll maybe get back and worry about that further if we've got time. Chosen by God, but the idea in Deuteronomy is we're not ready to bring this into force yet, and we'll get around to it when the time comes, so some later time. Then as we see what actually happens, the choice of the individual Saul, which seems in one sense to be premature, it's the people want it, and God warns them of the dangers and says, I'm going to let you have it, but you should have waited for me and such. Suggests perhaps that Saul is what was the best available at the time, and we might feel none too good, although it's very easy for us to judge people when we've never had to do the same things they have. So I'll resist that. The restrictions on the king are listed in Deuteronomy 17. He's to be an Israelite. He is to have few horses. What do you use horses for? Well, most of what we use horses for is not what they were used for in antiquity. The war is what they were used for. I wasn't around. Man didn't figure out how to use horses for agriculture until the Middle Ages. The old yoke techniques can't be used with horses. Something about their anatomy. It chokes them or presses on some arteries or something, and they can't pull a plow with a yoke. So it wasn't until they figured out some kind of a padded yoke that rested on the shoulders in the medieval period that horses were ever able to be used for that. So all they were used for was pulling lightweight carts, chariots, and by having people ride on their back, both of which were mainly military, occasionally some personal transportation, mainly military uses. So not multiplying horses means the fellow is not trying to put his security in military instead of his security in God. I think that's the point there. Not to multiply wives, that's got lots of possibilities. One of them is, again, military security. Alliances made with various other royal houses by marrying one of their daughters And so you have an alliance with the king of Egypt, an alliance with his other king of Gerar and such by these intermarriages. And the problem of idolatry, which shows up clearly in Solomon's reign, and just the problem of promiscuity as well, not being faithful to one wife, but multiplying wives. So all of those were restrictions, not to multiply wives. Not to multiply silver and gold exceedingly, the passage says. It suggests that to have a government, you got to have money. And so probably rulers are going to be pretty wealthy, but not exceedingly it ought not to be. I don't know what that tells us exactly in that area. We might all well feel that our government is multiplying money for itself exceedingly, and I would feel some sympathy for that. But at the moment, we're looking at the Old Testament arrangements here. I mentioned here that the fact that God had a period from Moses all the way up to David with no king suggests presumably that the question of a monarchy is not the most pressing matter in the world, that the kind of government that's important isn't so much its structure, but what the people do with it when they've got it, and whether they'll stay within God's bounds and such. There are certainly some remarks when the kingship is first being set up in 1 Samuel that suggest that a centralized government has a definite tendency to exploit people. It's got powers that a decentralized government doesn't have, and when they switch from the judge period to the king period, they're going to get into those problems, and I haven't dealt with them here. But yet we've got to say, on the other hand, that God's own form of government in the end is going to be a kingship of some sort. So God is not per se a democrat, using it in the non-republican sense, not the broader sense. Some ambivalence there, perhaps. Well, now I give you a number of examples here relating the interaction of the individuals and the offices, and we're certainly not going to have time to look at these in detail, but to show some interaction here. Ehud and Eglon, you may never have heard of. They occur in one chapter. Ehud is a judge, that is, a leader of Israel whom God raised up, not dynastic, raised up to deliver Israel from oppression. Eglon is the oppressor, a foreign king who's come into Israel, settled at Jericho, and is ruling the country from there. We have here the only example in Scripture of a biblically approved assassination. Ehud brings a hidden knife with him when he comes to deliver the tribute. He apparently is a trusted fellow. He's the one who's assigned to bring the tribute to pay off the guy that the Israelites owe. So whatever the donkeys and the associates with him, and they bring all the goods, whether it's gold and silver or agricultural goods, whatever. And he says, "I've got a secret word for you, O king." And so they go into a private place, and the secret message from God is an 18-inch, 2-edge sword, which he sticks all the way in. So there is an example of a political assassination that seems to have God's warrant to it. We'll have to come back and think a little bit about whether we've got warrant for anything of that sort today. But the incident of David and Saul and its contrast with Haziel, the next two examples here, rather suggest that one would need some kind of special revelation in that area. Saul certainly was not a great guy, although he at least has the advantage of being an Israelite and appointed over Israel by God himself, and therefore set aside by God. David is very, very careful that in spite of the fact that Saul is unrighteously out to kill him and has driven him out of the country so that he can't come to the tabernacle and worship and such, which certainly David felt was very important to faithfulness to God. There's a reference to "you're driving me out away from my inheritance and from the worship of my God" and such. Yet David is unwilling to kill him. David is going to let God take the time. He also already knows by revelation that God has chosen David to be a replacement for Saul. So David knows that Saul's time is coming up, and that David is the replacement, and that Saul is in the middle of trying to kill David, and yet David will not take the law in his own hands, so to speak, to carry the project out. He has him put to death for doing that. Haziel is a good contrast. Haziel is an official of the Syrian government, and one of the prophets tells him, "Look, you're going to be the replacement for Ben-Hadad." And Haziel takes that as a warrant to go kill the guy. So while the guy is recovering from a sickness, which the prophet says, "You'll recover," presumably meaning the sickness is not itself a sickness and kill him, Haziel makes sure he doesn't by dampening a cloth so that you can't breathe through it and sticking it over the king's face until the king asphyxiates. I think we see very clearly there a misuse of the whole relationship between God and government, if you like, and no such authority was given to Haziel by the prophet and by God. Examples of the king and the prophet, when the kingdom of Solomon is split into two pieces because his son Rehoboam is pig-headed and won't listen to good advice and tries to lord it over the northern kingdom so that they get so irked they leave. Rehoboam is about to take his army up and to take the place back. And the prophet Shemaiah shows up and says, nothing doing. This is from God, you stay home. And we can say for Rehoboam that he stayed home. We don't know whether his motives were totally satisfactory, but at least he had sense enough to obey God in this point instead of losing most of his army up north, which doubtless God could have arranged had Rehoboam chosen to send it up there. Jeroboam, however, the guy who was appointed over in the northern kingdom, is an excellent example of resisting the prophet. The prophet goes up and warns him of the false religion which Jeroboam has started, and Jeroboam tries to have the guy arrested. And it's only because God intervenes in a rather spectacular way, shriveling up Jeroboam's arm and such, and showing by a sign that this is God that's speaking through the prophet, that Jeroboam lets the guy go. But we see some resistance there. Ahab and Micaiah is a good incident of what appears to be a real responsibility to test the prophets, see whether they're true. Ahab has got this whole pile of prophets there, and all but Micaiah are saying, go up and win the battle. And Micaiah says, you go up, you'll not come back alive. And Ahab naturally does not like to hear that, because he wants to go up the battle. He wants to take the territories back that he's lost. And all these other guys are saying good things. And yet Ahab reveals already something about the righteousness of this prophet. He says to Micaiah never says good things about me. But Micaiah apparently just tells him what God says about him, which Ahab could have checked by reading Scripture. Ahab was doing lots of things that are mentioned in the King passage that you ought not to be doing. He already had a test. He had a doctrinal test on which guy was the right prophet, but he preferred instead to try out the historical test of which one was the prophet. So he says, feed this guy with bread and water till I come back. Micaiah says, if you come back alive, I'm not a true prophet. Well, Micaiah was a true prophet. The test was carried out, and I don't fault Ahab for being concerned to test it, but the test results were perhaps not to his liking. The incident of Joash and Zechariah, a king that had been going rather well to start with, but then turns aside, and when Zechariah, prophet, comes to tell him that he's disobeyed and God's going to punish him for it, Joash gets mad and has the fellow killed. And we see misuse again of the relationship between the king and the prophet. Two incidents regarding king and the priest are rather interesting ones. Uzziah's attempt to offer incense himself in the temple, a activity restricted to the priesthood. And it looks like the priest and his officials almost come to blows with him over it. He has about 100 men who are spoken of as valiant men. They're priesthood that are strong guys, ready to resist him, but God stops the confrontation by striking Uzziah with leprosy. And Uzziah quickly leaves the place, remains a leper the rest of his life. Adaliah is actually a queen, not a king, but the principle is no different. She attempts to wipe out the rest of the royal family and take over the place herself. And Jehoiada, knowing that, rulership was never given to Adaliah by God, and two, that there is still a heir alive of the Davidic line, organizes a revolt. And we see Jehoiada actually arranging a revolution and putting in charge this kid, who is the royal heir, and having Adaliah put to death. And so I think we see some functions going on there, where, of course, we have got some fairly definite revelation about the throne is to remain with David's family, and where Adaliah was definitely connected up with Jezebel and such, the Baal influence into the southern kingdom. There are a number of proverbs here on the duties of king and citizen, and I'll let you look those up. They are helpful in that they're telling you what to do. They're not just giving you a narration about something and letting you try to figure out what is going on here. But I've given just a little phrase on each one of what is going on in this incident. Let's move on quickly to New Testament teaching. Fear otherwise, we will either run over badly or not get through. There are three basic passages I picked out here in regarding the New Testament teaching on the relationship between the individual or the collective people of God and government authority. They're the paying taxes to Caesar incident in Matthew 22, the Roman 13 passage on the governor as God's minister to deal with evil, and the responsibility to live as servants of God seen in 1 Peter 2, 11 through 17. Let me summarize each of these rather quickly for you. The Matthew 22 incident is an incident in the ministry of Jesus in which Jesus' opponents think they have got a question they can ask him that he can't give an answer that won't get him in trouble. The rulership over Israel at that time is a Roman government, and they are not popular. They weren't elected. Okay? They are not spending the money as wisely as one might like. They have a big welfare program back home. They have a number of adventures on their boundaries that are being financed by the people they've conquered. Besides, their method of collecting taxes leaves something to be desired. They get guys who bid, high bid on what they can collect in taxes, and they give them the authority to go out and squeeze it out of the people. So lots of things going on there that are not totally satisfactory. They're minting the money in Palestine, and the money has got an image of a male on the front side. Bad enough to start with in terms of the commandment about making images. In addition to that, it calls the guy a son of the divine Augustus. So he's a son of God. It's got an image on the back of his mother, probably, or possibly a goddess. There's a little argumentation on who that's on the back of the coin is. And it claims that the emperor is the high priest. The Pontifex Maximus is the term used. You can see why the Jews weren't too happy about this coinage, but that was the coinage circulating in Palestine. And so their theory is, look, we can catch Jesus either way he answers. We're going to ask him if he ought to pay taxes to Caesar. If he says yes, all the people will be against him because nobody likes to pay taxes. If he says no, we'll just turn him over to the authorities because he's advocating treason. Looks like a perfect scheme. Bring along the two guys who could do it, the Herodians. We'll take the news to Pilate if he says don't pay taxes, and the Pharisees will take the news to the people if he says do pay taxes. Got him caught. Only trouble is it's very hard to trick God. And you try it out, you'll find out you're worse off than you were before you started. Jesus' answer is very clever. He says, let me see a coin. So someone digs into his wallet or whatever the equivalent was at the time and pulls out a coin. So either the Pharisees or the Herodians have one of these coins. My guess is they've all got these coins. I haven't run into any groups in antiquity that felt so badly about it they didn't use the coins. The temple appears to have been using shekels of Tyre, in fact, at this time, even though they had an image of the god Melkart on the front, but they were good silver. They knew what the fineness was, and they knew what the weight was, and they could count on it. So they weren't so sure about the emperor's coins. But they had the coin, so he gets one from them. He says, whose picture? Caesar's. Whose inscription? Caesar's. Well, if it belongs to him, give it back. Goes on to say a good deal more than that, right? He says, give back to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Give back to God what belongs to God. The statement is cryptic. It's intentionally cryptic. Jesus knew the Pharisees didn't really want to know the answer. The Pharisees and the Herodians wanted to get Jesus in trouble. He gives them an answer that can be interpreted lots of different ways, so that if they tell the governor that, what's the governor going to report? Jesus said, give Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Sounds okay. But everyone else knew that if the emperor was doing anything that God had not allowed the emperor to do, that's what the other half of the statement is about. Give to God what belongs to God. If the emperor claims to be son of God, but he's not, well, then don't you claim the emperor is son of God. If the emperor claims to be the chief priest, but he's not, don't you call the emperor chief priest. A very clever answer that goes exactly between the two dilemmas they set up. And yet it's also very striking in that it really says something about our relationship to government. It says, first of all, that there are things that belong to Caesar. That God has entrusted responsibilities of government to certain governors. It's fairly clear by reading other passages of Scripture, we'll get to a couple of them here maybe, that God has done this providentially. God is not saying Nero's a good guy. Nero may be a wicked guy. But God has providentially brought him into power. God didn't say the Assyrians were okay, but God did say the Assyrians are my instrument I'm going to use to punish the Israelites. I brought them to power. Doesn't justify lots of things they do, but I've actually given them something, and I didn't give it to you. I gave it to them. Okay? There is such a thing as authority structures, and if you're not in the top of it, that's because God has providentially not put you in the top of it. You don't have its responsibilities, and you don't have its rights. And if you are in the top of it, that's because God put you there, and you do have its responsibilities and its rights. And don't go meddling with the authority structures. If they're the ones God sets up, let him tear them down. You don't meddle too much. Notice the terminology here, top of page 4. He doesn't say, render to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to the temple what belongs to the temple. It's not a religion versus government question. It's a God and government question. I think we can tell very easily by reading what else Jesus has to say and by reading what else the Bible has to say that he hardly imagined that there was an equality of authority between Caesar and God. Now, here's the sphere that belongs only to Caesar. Here's the sphere that belongs only to God. And there's no overlap between the two. It's quite obvious, reading the Bible, that the Bible views every sphere as belonging to God, but that he's delegated some spheres to subordinates, and that one of these spheres is a governmental sphere. So, give Caesar what belongs to him. There may be some things that don't belong to him. And give God what belongs to him, and there isn't anything that doesn't belong to him. So, that, I think, is a picture which you have to work out from other passages. One of those passages is right here in Romans 13, verses 1 through 7, and let's read that quickly. Let every person be in subjection to the government authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same, for it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing, for it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. Wherefore, it's necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Particular features I see here in this passage. God is the source not only of authority in general, but of every particular authority as well. He's saying, providentially, I've allowed this person or that person to come into authority. We disobey God, then, in resisting authorities in general. That's not to say in every last circumstance. There may be some boundaries on this. But the general picture, we disobey God in resisting authority. Verses 3 and 4, government authority is intended to limit evil. And I would say it succeeds, even when it's not working too well. It succeeds in limiting evil. Now, admittedly, the person who's in authority is able to do more evil than he would be able to do if he weren't in authority. But he usually limits everybody else's ability to do evil by being in authority. There have been very few governments in the history of the world which can afford to set up laws that tell the citizens to do evil. Lie, cheat, steal, murder. If for no other reason than that the ruler doesn't want to get lied to, cheated, stolen from, and certainly not murdered. So you have had some terrible governments, no question. But even terrible governments have generally had a tendency to limit what everybody else could do in these areas. So I think they do function this way within the whole realm of a fallen society, okay? We're not talking about a society of perfect people, which hasn't existed yet, or at least on earth, has not existed since the fall. It serves God by rewarding the righteous and punishing the wicked. Therefore, we submit to it, both to obey God and to avoid government punishment. We must pay taxes, even tribute money to government. We must respect its officers and submit to them. We'll see that there are some boundaries on that, but that is the general principle, okay? They got the government authority, you don't. There are also some complications there with our own government where once or twice a year we've got the government authority. We have the authority to go in a little booth and push down on metal arrows and such, and we ought to do it right. And that's not a mechanical question. It's a the question of who those arrows have got below them that makes the morality of those actions, not the arrows themselves, which don't particularly have any morality about them. 1 Peter 2, verses 11 to 17. And 2 Peter 2, let me find 1 Peter 2. The love that I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. President Clark dealt with this last hour. Didn't get into this section as much. He says, look, you are aliens and strangers. Live like it. Live like citizens of heaven instead of like citizens of earth, like citizens of the fallen earth. Live like citizens of heaven. How? Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing which they slander you as evildoers, they may, on account of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Look, your lifestyle ought to be like citizens of heaven, so that even if somebody brings charges against you, slander is probably a court idea here, and maybe even get you convicted, one day they're going to realize who was right and who was wrong. The day of visitation. That may be the last judgment. That may be when they get saved. We don't know. The term can be used rather wide variety of ways. The writer may have intentionally done it that way. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority, or to governors as sent by him, delegated authorities by him, for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. It ought to become obvious to governing officials, if they know how to run their place at all, that Christians are good citizens, even if people are slandering them in other directions. It may take them a while to find out, but it ought to become obvious to them. Act as free men. Don't use your freedom as a coverage for evil, but use it as bond slaves of God. Honor all men. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the king. Okay, I've discussed 11 and 12. 13 and 14, this beautiful lifestyle involves submission to government authorities for God's sake. They're intended to reward the righteous and punish the wicked. Same theme of Romans. God's purpose in this for us is to put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. If we live in a way that we are not rebellious, they're going to have a hard time bringing those kind of charges and getting them believed over any long period of time. Don't use Christian freedom as a pretext for wickedness. Honor all, love Christians, fear God, honor the king. We've got to look at some specific examples quick, and then we've got to quit. Sorry, Tom. John the Baptist and Herod Antipas shows us that it can be right to publicly rebuke a political leader. Okay? We're not governors. We can publicly rebuke a political leader. This fellow, however, is a prophet sent by God. Does that let us out in some way? You have to think about that. You have to examine that in your own situation. Peter and John, in dealing with the temple authorities, aren't functioning so much as prophets there. They aren't saying, I've got a special revelation that I need to rebuke you or this or that. They have the Great Commission to go and make disciples of all nations, and the temple authorities are trying to interfere with it. The temple authorities are trying to say, our authority supersedes your authority from God to go do this. It doesn't. Our authority to proclaim the gospel is not superseded by some other government saying, you can't do that in our country. And we may have to take the consequences, like Peter and John, and particularly James did. James got killed over it. But we got that responsibility. We'll skip over Paul with the Sanhedrin. You kind of get the idea from a few of his remarks that he was a little uneasy about what he said to the high priest and about splitting the scribes and Pharisees, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, over the question of the resurrection. On both of those, he makes a remark about it later that seems to indicate maybe he shouldn't have done that. So I wouldn't want to make any principle that you can slander, call the governor names. You whitewashed wall is what he called the high priest, and he said he didn't realize it was a high priest. He backed off of it, and the other I would call a trick perhaps in splitting the Sanhedrin. So it suggests that we're to show respect to the authorities even when they don't, quote, deserve it, as long as they're not commanding us to do something that God has commanded and such. Paul with Felix and Festus and Festus and Agrippa basically shows that we have a responsibility to try and get government trials and such to abide by their own regulations of right evidence and such. If there's something going on where they're trying to put up a case on you, try and get them to stick to what they ought to do. Stick to the right procedure. Jesus does that himself in regard to his trial. He says, if I've done anything wrong, bring out the witnesses, he says. Don't just start slapping me around. And the same sort of thing comes up with Paul and with Festus Agrippa and Felix as well. He also uses the opportunity to present the gospel in these circumstances. We've had to rush near the end. I was afraid of this. Talks tend to get longer and longer. Let me sketch out for you a couple things I see here as conclusions that I think are expandable to us. One, quite satisfied this is safe. The Bible indicates there are definitely limits to the kind of authority man is delegated to any man, God has delegated to any man, whether that be state authority, whether it be religious authority, what it be. There are limits to it. Nobody has been given a blank check from God. The prophets come closest, but they're to be put to death if they say anything that you can be sure is not from God. They make a prediction that doesn't come true, you can be sure it's not from God. They're just to be put to death, okay? Very strong thing. They're given the nearest to a blank check. You're supposed to do everything they say. So it's got a very stringent thing if you catch the person and find out they are heading you, that they really aren't from God. The authority of the religious teachers appears to be what we would call persuasive and moral over the political authorities. They can tell them what they ought to do. They can't make them do it. The governor, the state authority, can make you do it, so to speak. Doesn't look like that's given to the priests or to the prophets and such. Admittedly, a couple of prophets have some pretty strong authority in bringing fire down from heaven and such, but it does not seem that that's their standard sort of procedure. Obedience to God takes precedence. All of us, in one sense, have got a direct line to God. Perhaps why we're called kings and priests in a couple of passages. It doesn't mean that any of us have as much right to rule the United States as President Reagan does. It does mean that if he or his successors or other persons tell us to do something God has told us not to do, it's God we follow and not this guy. And the same as if they try to stop us from doing something told us to do. However, we don't have any automatic right to rebel that I can see. There are many people who want to work off the scheme that the first time the government authorities ask you to do something they ought not to ask you to do, they don't have any authority over you again. Does not appear to be the biblical picture. You disobey them there on that point, but otherwise you obey them if you can't in other points. That their authority doesn't cease. They're going to have to deal with God on how they have misused their authority. But they're going to deal with that with God, not with us. And so it does not appear that we've got explicit warrant for rebellion, though we have to admit there's the case of Ehud, and there's the case of the high priest disposing Adaliah. But in both of those cases, you're in a clear theocracy, and the person is attempting to wipe out things that the Bible has said must be there. I don't know how to tell you to carry all of this over to our modern situation, because a lot of the argument is going to run on the question of whether our government is like a theocracy, or whether it's like one of the pagan governments. It looks to me like a mixture in certain areas. But I can tell you this, that I think all of these principles are clearly biblical, and that we need to think through each of the individual situations and try and do as best we can what we understand the Bible to, what the Bible's principles to be here. My guess is Christians are going to disagree on these things. Why should we be surprised about that? And that's society where the evangelical denominations probably number 150, we're not going to agree on how to handle a government situation all the time. But what we need to do, and we'll have a better place for it, is if each of us begin to try and apply biblical principles to how we interact with government and get out there and do what we think we ought to do on the basis of our study of Scripture, we'll have a better place. And these tensions are more likely to be resolved in the way to honor God if we're doing our part from that perspective. So I've just tried to share with you some principles. Tom Taylor is fuming out in the hall. Let us quit.
Biblical Theological Seminary is happy to have brought you this study in God's Word. We minister to people through our graduate and postgraduate degree programs, our community evening school, our cassette ministry, special seminars, and a free publication, Biblical Bulletin, containing interesting articles by biblical faculty members. For a free cassette catalog or more information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.